Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Japan's billions are on the table. Can Africa turn investment into industrialization and skills? The National Dialogue has been branded a letdown as activists accuse government of empty promises. The finance minister's crypto comments spark fears that South Africa could fall behind global investors. And the rise of the so-called super-duper shopper, that small group of people reshaping big retail decisions. It's Wednesday, the 20th of August. South Africa is in Yokohama this week for the Tokyo International Conference on African Development. It's where heads of state, ministers and business leaders are all in a room with Japan's political and corporate heavyweights. At the center of the discussions, as I understand it, how Japanese investment can help drive Africa's industrialization, skills development and energy transition. With President Ramaphosa leading the South African delegation and more than 40 of our business leaders present, what's really on the table for South Africa and for the continent? Joining us from Japan is Cas Kuvadia, B20 Sherpa, and is representing South Africa in this high-level business track. Cas, welcome to you. Beyond the speeches and the handshakes, and I'm sure there have been plenty of those, any tangible commitments that Japan has actually put on the table for this country and for the continent this week?
Jeremy, I haven't been involved in the government-to-government discussions, but from what I'm told, there were discussions between the president and a number of the top Japanese companies this morning, and I'm told that they were quite positive. So far, the conference itself has focused on a number of sessions for Japanese investors to understand the environment on the continent. I attended a session this morning, which five businesses from five different countries on the continent, in a session called Champions of African Business, actually gave real case study of how they grew their businesses and how they've become successful and what the opportunities are. And I must say that from the sessions that have been had thus far, the African case is being put forward fairly strongly. And today, for instance, the Japanese International Development Agency was there, as well as one of the state-owned banks was there. And their response was very positive, that they want to invest on the continent, that they understand that you can't look at the continent as a single entity, that there are countries that are making excellent progress in things like IT, fintech, startups, and so on. And so I've been here for the last 2 days, and I must say that I'm quite positive that the African message has been put across fairly clearly. And I would think that in the business-to-business interaction, which I'm not part of because I'm here as a B20 person, from what I've heard in the conference so far, I'm pretty sure that those will be positive.
Ultimately, though, Cas Kuvadia, it all comes down to pace, I think. Japan has a reputation for patient, long-term investment, but yeah. Africa and South Africa in particular needs urgency. It's going to be difficult, will it not, to reconcile those two speeds?
Yeah. I think that's something that needs to be discussed. But also, I think that what was quite clear is that certainly in today's sessions, in things like fintech and startups and so on, a view coming from some people, some African companies that are already investing in that, and from some of the startups themselves, that they appreciate that they actually need patient capital, and they The IFC, for instance, made the point that it took at least 10 years for startups in Saudi Arabia, for instance, to actually raise the capital and grow and actually become sustainable. And so for significant parts of investment, particularly in the tech space, in the startup space, in the businesses do need patient capital, and I think Japan can give them that. As far as, the sort of urgent capital that we need, particularly in South Africa and for infrastructure and so on, again, I think that certainly the state banks that were participating in the sessions today understood that that is necessary, and they also acknowledge that Japan has been less than active on the continent, but that they see the opportunities in the continent and that they want to engage to actually see if they can play a role in that. So at least there was an acknowledgement of that. Yeah.
Notwithstanding that, Cass, Japanese companies are also known for being cautious and maybe risk averse. I am generalizing here. But given South Africa's policy uncertainty and issues around infrastructure and power and water, it surely is difficult to persuade them to invest here.
Well, I think that we do need to do a lot of stuff back home to actually create that environment for investment. But I think that certainly, when I've been talking to people, it is difficult. Of course, it's difficult. Mm-hmm. I also met with Alistair Reuters early this morning, who's working with the president to try to speak to investors. And we acknowledge that it's difficult. But I think that I certainly talk to people about the fact that as a business community in South Africa, we're not saying that the investment climate is perfect. We're saying there are plenty of problems, but that we are working with government to try and address capacity issues in government, that we are committed to the country, and that we will hear them when they talk about the environment for investment, but we'll also talk to them about the progress that has been made and our assessment of whether we're going on the right track or not. And they seemed interested in that.
Let me push that thought a little further. We're also, if I understand this correctly, pitching ourselves as a bridge between Africa and global investors. Is there anything that we are offering Japan that they're not going to get elsewhere on the continent?
No, I don't think so. I think that my own view is that sure, there are sectors of the economy that are already established in South Africa that will use South Africa as a base for the continent, and they must, because it makes sense, it makes economic sense to do so if it works for their businesses on the continent. But I think that to say that African economies are dependent on South Africa to be a bridge for investment on the continent, I don't think is the approach we should be taking. As I said, I think there are some established companies that can use it as a base. But there are a number of African countries that are leapfrogging us on fintech, on IT, on digitalization, on a number of issues. And a number of African countries that are unequivocally creating an environment for investment. And that is why they're attracting the investment. So I think that there's a lot we can learn from countries on the continent. I think that there are certain areas, given the diverse economy we have and the global companies that have invested in our economy over the last couple of decades, we can act as some sort of a springboard for some sectors of the economy. But I think that in many parts of the economy, there's a great deal we can learn from the continent.
I appreciate the very frank assessment. Talking to me from Yokohama in Japan at the Tokyo International Conference on African Development, that's South Africa's B20 Sherpa Cass Kouvadia.
Mind-blowing, innovative, and internationally acclaimed, Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other. A unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projected dinner filled with fun, surprise, and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win two tickets worth nearly 4,000 rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy 6 unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events at moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff. Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the much-anticipated national dialogue meant to bring South Africans together to chart a way forward. Instead, the early phases, at least, have been slammed by many NGOs and activists as a letdown, riddled with exclusions, walkouts, and what some call empty promises. Even the Deputy President, Paul Mashatile, not happy with the process. I want to discuss this fallout, and I'm joined by Thembelihle Ntandane from the activist group Sonke Gender Justice. Thembelihle, welcome to you. You were there. What do you think went wrong?
A lot happened. I think there were a lot of logistical issues. There was a lot of issues with the panelists that were there. The whole process just didn't really feel inclusive and co-created with people who actually do work on the ground. There were some civil society representatives there, but the whole process really felt exclusionary. And there was a point where there were dialogue labs where people could, you know, go out into that sort of breakout rooms where they shared their opinions on certain things, where we were told to dream of South Africa, you know, the different sectors, unemployment, education, and when we realized that in the morning, the presentation was given by the team, and a lot of people who were in the different dialogue labs felt that their inputs were not properly reported. The issues were sort of diluted, and we then asked to have the labs be the ones to give feedback for themselves. And that really, you know, played into the mistrust that was already there and is already there in the country around this dialogue. So it was just a lot of issues around co-creation and really helping understand that, you know, this is a process that is citizen-led, but it doesn't really have the voices of the people on the ground.
So I'm paraphrasing the president here when he said that no voice was too small to be heard. Do you think that this sidelining was deliberate or just poor planning?
It was poor planning. It was poor planning from the get-go. I think, you know, the noise around this dialogue and how it was supposed to happen and the partners that were supposed to be involved in the process, pulling out at the 11th hour really did put out the credibility, and it didn't really feel that there was a consideration of every single voice in the room. I know at some point, people with disabilities felt very excluded. There was a number of groups that felt they were not properly represented. And I think if they had planned it on time and maybe even had those partners on board, they would have been better advised on how to go about really including each and every single voice in the room, especially voices of young people as well. We didn't see quite a number of young people in the room, you know, despite the fact that they count for a third of the population. So those were the issues that I think with proper planning and time and the correct advice, it would have come together, but it was quite chaotic.
So how do you keep civil society engaged then after this disappointment?
I think it's important that civil society is in the steering committee to better advise the process. So later there was a steering committee selection at the end of day two. And so we hope that as much, especially vocal organizations, would be in the steering committees to better advise the process and to ensure that each and every single South African is represented, and especially people in the marginalized communities, to ensure that, you know, the voices of all South Africans are heard. So I think it's civil society actually has a big role to play here, not only because they represent big constituencies, but they have the voice. I think especially in the gender sector, we've seen a lot of organizations, Black Women Caucus, you know, Call to Action Movement, you know, sources, all of those organizations have a very big voice and a big role to play in really shaping how this looks like on the ground.
I'm just wondering, as I hear you talk to me, whether the problem isn't the size and the promise of the inclusivity. Is the process not too big and unwieldy to make any difference at all?
The process, it doesn't feel or seem very thought through. I think we raised it even at the dialogue that the curriculum or the toolkit itself needs to, you know, the roadmap there's people who already in that draft, or whether it's a draft or not, but that roadmap that they presented did not seem to put into consideration a number of things, you know, the complexities of local municipalities, you know, taking things at the ward level has a lot of complexities, and it doesn't seem that there's those things, you know, so the size is very big and they're taking on a very big task, but also there's a lot of complexities that are not necessarily being considered, and we're hoping that people who will be in the steering committees would be able to advise on that.
It's always going to be a difficult job, though, given the competing agendas.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think we can't... One thing that I think what they failed to do is really bring people back into confidence about the credibility of this thing. It seems very highly politicized. There's a lot of, you know, issues around legacy foundations and Thabo Mbeki versus President Cyril Ramaphosa. So I think they failed to really bring us back into confidence that this is credible. This is not an electioneering stunt, you know, going towards local government elections and just another way to win votes, you know, different strategy that the ANC is employing. So I think they really failed to bring South Africans into confidence that they actually know what they're doing. And I think that's where the role of civil society plays out. It is very, it's going to be a very complex process. I don't think it's easy at all. And if the issues of the credibility of this thing continue and the noise around the conflicting ideas and opinions about it, it might steal away from what this is actually supposed to be for South Africans.
And it doesn't fill one with any confidence when the deputy president himself walks out.
Exactly. I think that was a very big bone of contention. He didn't really give an address either. So I think that's what I'm saying, that we were not brought into confidence that anybody knows what's really going on other than the president. So yeah, it doesn't bring us into confidence. And we saw a lot of things coming into play. Yeah, like the chaos on stage and the panelists. I think also the substance of the panels that presented on the first day really left more questions than answers.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Thembelihle Ntandane, senior trainer at the organization Sonke Gender Justice.
Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the MoneyWeb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MoneyWebGuest when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa could be missing out on the digital financial boom. The finance minister, Enoch Godongwana, has doubled down on his stance that collective investment schemes should not be allowed to invest in crypto assets. He cites risk and investor protection, but global markets, it seems, are moving the other way. And platforms like Luno say the restrictions are holding South Africa back. Well, let's discuss this a little further. I'm in conversation now with Marius Reitz, who's General Manager for Africa and Europe at Luno. Marius, a warm welcome. And why then do you think the minister's comments are a setback for South Africa?
Hi, Jeremy. Firstly, I think, as you've said in your introduction, currently crypto assets like Bitcoin is not permitted as an underlying investment asset in collective investment scheme products, so that like exchange traded funds, unit trusts, etc. And the implications of that is that investors, retail and institutional investors, are then left with no choice but to rather invest their capital in US-based listed funds. And this has various implications for us. Firstly, those investors now need to utilize their offshore investment allowances. Many investors are already at their maximum offshore limits. It's withholding the local crypto industry from growth. It's withholding the economy from job creation, but also from innovation, much needed innovation. And there's also a high tax opportunity cost for the country. So I think that the bottom line is that, Jeremy, there is a clear demand. Retail institutional investors want to gain Bitcoin exposure. This demand is clear and it's established. And Bitcoin is no longer a fringe asset. And we can go through all the Bitcoin growth and adoption metrics as well. But the bottom line is it's a $2.3 trillion asset. It's in the top 10 global assets according to market capitalization. It offers returns that cannot be compared to the traditional markets. Yes, it also offers a degree of risk. And the demand is clear. We've seen almost $165 billion of investment flowing into US-based exchange-traded funds. And many of that, you know, could have been invested in emerging markets like South Africa.
And Marius, it's that degree of risk, as you call it, that is obviously worrying the finance minister.
No, absolutely. It's still a new asset class. It's been around for, let's say 17 or so years. But we've also made tremendous progress over the last couple of years, Jeremy. I think just if you consider locally, the progress on the regulatory front, the Financial Intelligence Center, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, those are all now have stepped in as regulators of the industry. Crypto assets are classified as financial products alongside many other types of financial products. The industry is regulated. There are many very sophisticated and leading firms that are leading firms globally, locally in South Africa. If you look at some of the risks, yes, price volatility, it has subsided. But we're really talking about a small allocation, Jeremy, a 1-3 or 1-5% allocation. There is still that need to be responsible in that. So 1-3 or 1-5% allocation, we think, is the responsible thing to do. We'll send a strong signal to the private sector, to asset managers. Many of the country's largest asset managers want to offer Bitcoin-backed products to their clients, but cannot do so at this moment. And that stifles growth.
Marius, is the minister wrong then when he warns against, and I quote, unsophisticated investors being exposed?
Look, Jeremy, investors will invest in anything, right? It's not possible to control what investors will invest in. But our belief is that if you offer investors a regulated crypto product that's traded on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, that actually does a lot from an investor protection perspective. Investors will find ways to gain exposure either directly through a crypto investment app, or they will invest offshore, or they will find other means to gain crypto exposure. In effect, what you're doing is you're also pushing the market underground to some extent. So we think that publicly listed or traded crypto-backed investment product will actually bring the market to the front. It will make it safer for investors because you will have the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, for example, to also provide that degree of oversight around the issuers of those products.
So what clarity then do you want to see from the central bank's upcoming framework in that respect?
Yeah, Jeremy, I think it's quite simple. I think we want the finance minister and national treasury to have an open mind. We want them to consider including crypto assets in Board Notice 90. Board Notice 90 stipulates the type of investments that may be included in portfolios of collective investment schemes, so ETFs and unit trusts. And we don't want them to just blindly exclude crypto assets from the coming amendments to Board Notice 90. We think that will be a positive move. It will enable the industry and the crypto industry, but also the traditional asset management industry, asset managers, to also enter the debate and start having healthy conversations around allowing crypto assets or a small single percentage allocation to crypto assets in these products.
Talking about healthy conversations, what overtures then is your organization either making to the central bank or to the finance minister?
Yeah, Jeremy, we are the cryptocurrency pioneers in South Africa, having been in the market since 2013. We have played various roles, engaging with the regulators, the SA Reserve Bank, the FSCA, over the last number of years. We are actively engaging National Treasury around very important regulatory building blocks that also need to be put in place. For example, currently it's still unclear whether crypto assets are deemed as an onshore asset, whether it can exist onshore, or whether it's viewed as an onshore asset. And that also has implications for institutions. So we're engaging with the Reserve Bank on that point. We feel very strongly that crypto assets should be classified as an onshore asset, meaning when investors, retail and institutional investors, invest in crypto assets that they do not utilize any foreign exchange allowances. And that will also then give the asset management fraternity that comfort to start building products and offering products that track the price of crypto assets like Bitcoin to their client bases.
Marius Reitz, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The digital age and now the artificial intelligence era, promising speed, convenience and endless choice. But according to the just released 7th South African Consumer or Customer Experience Report, shoppers are telling brands something very different. Don't forget the human touch. The report finds that while consumers are happy to browse, buy and research online, we all still crave empathy, personal connection and real world experience. With me is Charlie Stewart, Chief Executive Officer of the agency Roger Wilco and a co-author of the report. Charlie, a very warm welcome. Your report this year says consumers want more human connection in a digital first world. Was that a surprise for you?
Jeremy, I don't think it is a surprise. I do think that over the last few years, as we've embarked on this sort of rush towards digitization, that we've lost sight of some of the fundamentals. And it feels to me as though as business owners and as consultants, there's been a desire for people to try to find silver bullets, single solutions to complex problems, because it's better if it's more efficient. But I think that in much the same way as the best recipe is a concoction of different ingredients rather than a single element, we also need to recognize that if we're going to deliver great experiences, we need to combine the best of technology from an efficiency perspective with the best of human contact from an empathetic perspective.
All well and good. In fact, I think you call that bothism. It's balancing digital tools with physical stores. But what does that actually mean for a business? What do they need to do?
Well, I think if we look at it from a retail perspective, over the last decade, we've all been trumpeting the advance of e-commerce. And you know, if you just measured it by sheer column inches, you would assume that e-commerce vastly dwarfed physical retail. The converse is true. E-commerce still accounts for less than 10% of Africa. And so it means that we need to get that balance right. E-commerce is fantastic from an efficiency perspective. It allows you to go online, do your research, see where stock is. But people crave the opportunity to walk into a physical store and touch stuff. And we're seeing that manifest in the physical retail environment. I mean, Nike has recently opened up its concept store in the V&A waterfront. Woolworths just a couple of weeks ago rolled out two big stores in the northern suburbs of Cape Town to huge media acclaim that really put the person, the human, at the heart and center of the experience.
And part of that, Charlie, is empathy. And you say that almost 95% of consumers say empathy is critical, but very different as far as businesses are concerned. There's a gap there, a disconnect.
Yes, we've seen quite a significant disconnect here where consumers feel that it's extremely or very important for brands to demonstrate an emotional connection with them. By contrast, only about 40% of the companies felt that 40% felt that delivering great functional experience was more important than delivering meaningful empathy. And I think it comes down to the needs and wants of people. We all want to feel noticed, but a business also wants to make sure that the product that it's delivering to you or that it's selling to you is working, is delivered on time. So I can understand why there was a bit of a gap there. But there were other areas too where we felt that businesses were somewhat detached from consumers. We saw that in the different channels and media that consumers find useful when they're looking for products and services. Businesses, were a little bit off the charts there in terms of where they felt consumers would go to find information and what was valuable. And I think another area that we saw a disconnect was businesses seem to feel that consumers' perception of their brand is way more important than it actually is. We saw, I think it was 27% of businesses said that they feel that their brand values really resonate with consumers, and that's why people continue buying from them. Only 13% of consumers felt that. By contrast, consumers continue to say that they value a brand's efforts to take accountability, to take sort of sustainability into account. Whereas very few businesses felt that consumers paid any attention to ESG factors.
This is an interesting one, the rise of a person called the super duper shopper. Who are they and why do they matter?
They're high net worth individuals, typically with a household income of 30,000 rand plus. They are very tech savvy. And they're generally in the sort of 30 plus age group. And they matter because they are the super users of e-commerce, but they are also the super users of physical retail. So they are the people who are, I suppose, your super consumer. And they are more active on social media than regular consumers. They are more likely and more inclined to share news of good experiences, but also news of poor experiences than regular consumers. So it's important that brands understand who they are and cater to their needs and make sure that they do not deliver service lapses.
What about the notion of brand loyalty? Is that fading into the distance?
No, it's not. But I mean, it is an area where we're seeing an element of disconnect between business and consumer. I think one of the only areas where we saw the two parties were aligned was when it came down to provision of value for money, where both rated that more or less equally. But I think that loyalty will always be there, provided product and service is fit for purpose.
Many businesses are now betting, Charlie Stewart, on artificial intelligence. We know that. But the challenge is using it optimally while not alienating customers and making sure that there is beneficiation as far as that tech is concerned. Easier said than done.
Very interesting question, Jeremy. And we were quite surprised at the feedback we received on this one. So we asked both of our consumer and our business panelists whether they were comfortable or felt that consumers were comfortable with AI being deployed. And the consumers were far more comfortable. 37% said they were very comfortable with businesses using AI versus just 16% of businesses feeling that consumers would be very comfortable. So there was it almost felt as though businesses were being, you know, slightly more apprehensive or neutral in their rollout of AI than consumers were feeling about it. And so I think that by and large, if AI is being used to improve the functional efficiency of customer experience, we as consumers are more than happy with it. We just don't want it to erode our ability to talk to a human when we need to talk to a human.
And that's where we are going to leave it. We've been talking about the 7th South African Customer Experience Report. I've been in conversation with Charlie Stewart, one of the co-authors of the report, and he is Chief Executive Officer of the agency, Roger Wilco. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.